This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a lot of plastic in our clothing, and a lot of that ends up in the environment, one way or another. Find out about the impact of the clothing we wear and why there may not be easy solutions to some of the problems. Now, the U.S. economy added 236,000 jobs in March. That's slower than job growth in February, but it's still seen as a healthy number, especially after recent rises in the interest rate. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates 9 times over the last year in an effort to slow down high inflation. New numbers on inflation during March are expected to come out tomorrow. A Wisconsin economist joins us now to look at the latest news and what it means for us at the store, on the job, at the gas pump, and in our job searches. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're looking for a job, have you been able to find them in your line of work? If you're an employer trying to hire people, what are you seeing? Have you noticed prices for things you buy at the store going up, down, staying the same lately? Are you buying or selling a house? How's that going? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your personal observations, or your economic questions. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Yamin Ahmad is professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. Yamin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
A lot of pieces of the puzzle here. Let's start with those job numbers. Unemployment rate in March, 3.5%, pretty close to a 53-year low. Looks pretty good. What do you make of that that job report from last month?
It's still, the data is kind of showing that the, at least in the labor market, it's still pretty healthy and pretty strong, that businesses are looking to hire workers, and there's quite a lot of new jobs being created every month. And so typically, again, we tend to think of anything above 200,000 jobs a month as a sort of like a indicator for a fairly healthy economy. And that's, you know, if we get above that, that's great news. So on the labor market front, at least, there's big demand for hiring workers, and new jobs are being posted all the time.
There's a lot of good news, bad news going on lately, Yamin. Yeah. So, okay, great job numbers. Hold on. What about inflation? The Federal Reserve kind of wants those job numbers to go down a little bit, I think. So when you see good job numbers, what does that make us and maybe make the Federal Reserve think about inflation?
Sure. So the Federal Reserve has this dual mandate. So part of what it's mandated to do, there's two things. One is to stabilize prices and inflation, and the other thing is to try and achieve maximum employment. So when we look at the job numbers right now, as you mentioned, it's an unemployment rate net across the country is about 3.5%. When we kind of compare that to what we call the natural rate of unemployment, or if you kind of think of it as like a long-term unemployment rate, that number is a little bit higher at about 4.5%. So that means we're currently doing pretty well because our current unemployment numbers are below that long-term average, if you will. And so from the Federal Reserve's perspective, as the part of its mandate that it's doing pretty well on is the unemployment side. So its concern and its focus has been pretty much on trying to bring inflation down. And given the numbers that we're seeing, you know, obviously I'm not in the room that they, when they decide these things, but, that, you know, they have about a 1% point, 1% gap there that they can sort of utilize to try and bring inflation down as much as possible. So that's kind of the what we call the policy space that they have, that they're working with, and their thinking is sort of that, you know, they can try and bring inflation down. There may be a little bit of a rise in unemployment, but it'll still be hopefully below that. They'll hopefully keep it below that natural rate of unemployment, this kind of long-term unemployment number that they're aiming for. So the Fed never actually explicitly says what unemployment numbers it said it is going for. The inflation number, the inflation target is pretty well defined, but the unemployment target is a bit more vague, which gives them a little bit of room for discretion. But that's kind of typically what we think of as this this long-term unemployment rate is kind of what they would like to be at or under that. So for them to sort of succeed on that part of the mandate. So yeah, everything that they're trying to do is kind of focus on inflation at the moment, given that the labor market seems to be doing pretty well.
Let's talk about inflation rates now. We were, you know, dancing around 10% for a while there. That number you're talking about that the Fed wants is, I believe, 2-ish%. Well, split the difference. We're like right in the middle of that 6%, watching for a number tomorrow. Predictions are it might be a wee bit lower. Still kind of stubborn and trying to get to that 2%, though.
And that's very true. I mean, so when, you know, in my own work and others, that we kind of found that inflation in the US tends to be very persistent, meaning that, you know, once if inflation ramps up, it takes a really long time for it to come down, even with monetary policy trying to bring it down. So in many ways, you can kind of think of that as, you know, going from 10% to 6% has been the easy part. Going from 6% down to that 2% you're mentioning, it could be a lot harder because inflation will kind of tend to stick around because of a bunch of different factors, because of the fact that, you know, when we look at when businesses change their prices, it's not all together at once in response to what monetary policy is doing. That's kind of staggered over the course of the year. But there are other factors that can you know, lead to that persistence that we see from, you know, what's happening with wages, but also what people are expecting to happen to inflation, what we call inflation expectations, can actually be a big driver of actually what drives the inflation process itself. So it's a large part of it is the Fed's still got their work cut out for them in terms of trying to get down to that 2%. And again, given the current framework that the Federal Reserve uses is something called average inflation targeting. They're trying to get to a 2% average over some period of time. So as long as the average of inflation has been 2% over some period of time, then that's, they're kind of considering that they've met their target for there. So I would expect inflation numbers to slowly come down. But you know, John Williams and others who are on the committee are you know, saying that it's still a road ahead to try and get to that 2% that they want to aim for.
We are talking about the economy, the big picture stuff with Yamin Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. Love to hear how you are experiencing all of this. Is there something important to you that you buy on a regular basis where the price went up? Has it come back down? Are you looking for a job? Are you offering jobs? What does that look like right now in this economy? Oil production cut a little bit. Are you seeing the impact of that at the pump lately? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your personal economic report. Oh, yeah, mortgage rates on houses. You looking to buy a house now? Things are a little different than they were a few years ago. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Yamin, the Federal Reserve, one of their tools is to set interest rates. That sort of indirectly changes what people pay when they borrow money, including to do things like buy houses or cars.
Yes.
How is that affecting us right now?
So, as you also said, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates, and we're up to just under 5%, right? The particular interest rate that they target is something called the federal funds rate, and all sort of like other interest rates are sort of tied into that Fed funds rate measure that the Federal Reserve tries to change. And so one of the things that we've seen is that obviously over the past year or so, mortgage rates have obviously gone up quite a lot. We've seen interest rates on credit cards go up and other loan rates that that banks and others typically charge, they've all sort of increased over time. So the idea is that the Federal Reserve, by changing interest rates, by adjusting interest rates, they're trying to make it more expensive to borrow. And in trying to really slow down the economy and slow down spending and try and get to taming inflation that way. So that's sort of broadly the process of the Federal Reserve, how it works in terms of when it implements monetary policy. But unfortunately, one of the things of that is that that process is also very slow. So, you know, all the interest rate hikes that, you know, happened over this past year, they're starting to have an effect. And as you see inflation coming down, it's still the impact of all those interest rate rises are still in many ways to be felt down the road. I mean, you could still be looking at the end of this year before the full effect of what happened last year, you know, is materializes. And so the Fed also sort of plays this guessing game in some ways, not in terms of trying to assess what's currently happening with economic conditions and whether they need to keep raising interest rates. They try and make forecasts for where the economy will be. And so that's kind of where they are right now. They're trying to they raised rates quite aggressively last year, but those rate hikes have kind of have slowed down a bit, in part because the Fed is trying to see how much of an impact that they have on the economy and do they need to kind of keep raising rates more. I would expect At the next meeting, that they probably will still raise interest rates, but we'll see what the data comes in tomorrow, and the output numbers that are coming in at the end of the month, the preliminary estimate for the first quarter, what kind of impact is having, and you know, the Fed obviously looks at all this data before making the decision.
So. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hello.
Listening to the guest here, so my comment, I've worked in manufacturing sector for roughly 25 years, and in that sector I see a change in buying incoming raw material goods away from the Asia market, certain markets in Asia where they typically have lower labor costs, to shift in buying more goods, raw materials from our European partners or sourced locally within the United States, which typically has higher labor costs. And we're seeing higher incoming raw material rates. And I just wondered if you could maybe speak to that as how you see that translating to whether it's inflation or economic stability here.
Interesting.
Forward.
Chris, great question. And Yaman, I had seen pre-COVID stories about reshoring, doing some of what Chris was just talking about there, manufacturing and raw materials, trying to source them closer. Then COVID, then sure. The supply chain craziness. Are you seeing companies do more of what Chris is saying and saying, yeah, we want our stuff sourced a little closer to home?
Yeah, I've looked at some preliminary data on that, and there seems to be some evidence of that going on for sure. I think in part that there's economic uncertainty across the world, and when that happens, you're trying to leverage that and try and get some hedge against that, to try and get some degree of certainty in terms of where you can get your resources from. Certainly, what Chris was mentioning with regards to like commodity prices and producer prices, they did go up, and I think in the most recent data that I've seen is that when you look at the producer price index, that's actually starting to slowly come down. And typically one of the things that we see is that this producer price index typically it moves ahead of the consumer price index, if you will.
Indicator, they call that.
Yes, so exactly. So the changes in the producer price index often are a good predictor for what might happen to consumer price index. And so when we see, in the most recent data, I think if I remember, the PPI has kind of come down quite a bit. I think it's down to about 2.37% or something like that. And so on that basis, I would expect, it to have a downward pressure on consumer prices as well. So, I think a lot of what will happen is that as supply chains reorient themselves, as commodity prices, there's still shortages and things in mm-hmm. certain markets, but they're slowly changing over time. Their contribution to inflation, I think, had a big impact during COVID, but their impact is slowly waning as markets sort of over time kind of clear themselves. So I don't know if that answers your question, Chris, but hopefully I get to what you're asking.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Yaman Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater, looking at the latest economic news. There's lots of it, including slower but still healthy looking job growth in March. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're looking at the U.S. and global economy. You can tell us how it's affecting your personal economy. Job searching for people to fill jobs, buying, selling houses, refinancing mortgages, you name it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Yaman Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. We're checking in on the economy after new jobs numbers and ahead of the Federal Reserve's next policy meeting. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your observations, your questions. Back to your calls now. Adam is with us in Deerfield. Adam, hi.
Hi. Just had a quick question for your guest in regards to refinancing. We were in a variable that started getting very, very high, mm-hmm. and we refinanced into a fixed that was also high but at least stable, and we're just wondering if you have a prediction of the future as to when might be a good time to look at refinancing to try to get it at a lower fix.
Adam, thanks a lot for the call. We can't predict the future, Yemen. I feel like there's probably bad news for Adam. I think the only way interest rates are likely to drop a lot is if we have a really bad recession, right?
That's true. Looking at mortgage rates, I think the 30-year fix, I thought sort of in the recent data, I think peaked at about 7%. That's actually come down a little bit. But I think with continuing interest rate hikes, I think that I'm expecting to happen at least through quite a lot of this year. Really, unless the economy ends up going into a recession, we may not see interest rates really come down. So it's hard to predict because there's a bunch of things that can obviously happen. But certainly, I think for the foreseeable future, I would expect at least maybe even 2 years or more before we start to see interest rates really come down. So I have sort of bad news on that front. I would not expect mortgage rates to really come down significantly unless there's some other external factor that like kind of pushes us into recession that really starts to, then the Fed might have to kind of think back about the unemployment numbers and reassess there. So yeah, I would not expect, in at least for the foreseeable future, interest rates to really, and mortgage rates to really come down, even on fixed term.
Sorry, we don't have better news for you, Adam, but thanks for calling in. Now, Yemen, Adam, not the only one to be burned by interest rates going up. This is affecting the economy. The Silicon Valley Bank collapsed. Part of the story there is we've got lots of cash on hand. We're going to put it into these, at the time, low-yielding treasury bonds. Interest rates go up. They're in effect. They've got lots of money sunk into these low-yield investments that could have been doing a lot better. That was part of the story of what went wrong, as I understand it. Is that bank collapse and another one a concern, a red flag for the rest of the economy?
I think the part of it is that when interest rates are low, as you know, typically, you know, coming out of recessions and so on, when we've seen that over the majority of, you know, since the Great Recession till about 2014, 2015, interest rates are pretty low and the Fed started raising interest rates. One of the things that we see banks and other institutions try and do is obviously they're not getting a big return from these like low interest assets. And so there's some incentive to try and get higher returns, but there's also a higher risk in those things. The thing with Silicon Valley, obviously, that happened was that as the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates, then the value of the assets on their balance sheets actually fell because, of course, with higher interest rate, there's an inverse relationship between the price of those assets and the return on those assets, right? So, on the balance sheet, the value of their assets sort of essentially not depreciated, but it fell, and that kind of caused them to seek funds, and then they ended up where they were. The big thing for the Federal Reserve at the time and the U.S. economy for other policymakers was to make sure that this wasn't a systemic event and that it didn't spread to other banks, because obviously people would lose confidence in the banking system. There could be a lot of bank runs, and as people try to pull out the money, and that would be have a big impact on financial markets. And so part of the reason why the Fed did what they did, and the FDIC obviously stepped in to try and shore up the banks and make sure that it didn't create a bank run on other banks and make uncertainty a lot bigger. So, I think a large part is that we really saw the two big banks, Silicon Valley Bank and then Signature Bank. I guess it was about a month ago. They're taken over by the FDIC, and then thankfully it didn't spread to other banks that were in trouble. And one of the things that we've seen is that since the financial crisis of 2007-2009, that banks typically have to, they are stress tested and there's a bigger capital requirements for them just in the case of bank runs and so on. And so there's different scenarios that have played out. I think especially in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, the Federal Reserve was trying to tell them you need to do better, but some of that advice wasn't taken on board, I guess. So yeah, and they ended up where they are. But yeah, I think, but it's certainly a thing that policymakers are keeping an eye on, and the Federal Reserve especially, on financial markets, and make sure that there isn't a systemic risk. Sorry.
And Yemen, there's one more thing that actually led me to have Aswata call you. OPEC, OPEC Plus now, yes. Saudi Arabia led, yes. plus Russia. They cut yes. production some on oil. Now I'm looking at a big long-term oil cost chart. I wouldn't want to ride that roller coaster. There's a lot of headlines about this cut. It bumped prices up a little, but it didn't seem too shocking. What do you make of that?
I think part of it is because when we see, so if you're looking at your gas prices this past week, they went up a bit. I think a large part is that there's a couple of things that have been happening over the last, I guess, 5 to 10 years, maybe structurally. I think people have been seeing higher gas prices, and so there's expenditure switching effect. So trying to find alternatives that are cheaper for them. That's part of why some of that price impact maybe didn't have quite as effect. But the other thing is that there's in the news, there's already been a lot of news about high inflation. And so part of when we see this happening with OPEC, some of that was already sort of incorporated in the price already, if you will. So so it's good and bad news, because I would have actually expected there to be more of a change than more of an impact than what did happen. But it could also indicate that, you know, the market has kind of realized that we're in high inflation territory, and the effects of those higher inflation terms has kind of already been passed on to prices already. So they may not be as quite as big an impact.
Yeah, I mean, we covered a lot of ground today. We'll leave it there. Sure. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Yaman Ahmad, professor of economics at UW-Whitewater. He was with us to talk about the latest U.S. employment numbers, what they mean for inflation, the Federal Reserve's next move on interest rates, gas, and lots more. If there's a part of the economy you want to hear more about, let us know. And how it affects you in particular, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear what's on your mind, and maybe see if we can tackle it in a future conversation here on Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a former Olympic runner shares some behind-the-scenes scandals with issues of doping, abuse, and more in a high-profile training program. Meet the author of the new book, The Longest Race, to get the story behind those scandals, how it affected the sport, and you can join in with your own questions for the author. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. So I'm working in my office this afternoon, and I hear some hullabaloo outside my office window. I looked out and down and saw a small crowd of people on the fourth floor landing of the building, each of them armed with a sword and a dagger. But don't be alarmed. That's the kind of thing that happens when you share a building with the university theater department. It looked like they were training for some theatrical fight choreography. I don't know if it was a class or a company for an upcoming play. First thing they did was put down their weapons and did some unarmed work on stances and lunges. Then came the swords, then the two-weapon work. Now, of course, maybe I misread the whole situation and the Montagues were down there getting ready for some trouble with the Capulets. But soft, what fight through yonder window breaks? This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Microplastic pollution is getting more attention and research in the last few years. It's been discovered in oceans, the Great Lakes, even in beer. There's a lot of reasons microplastics get into the environment. One way is from our clothing. Throwing out clothes with synthetic fibers, even doing the laundry, can release those microplastics. But there are some ways we can help cut down on our pollution footprint. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you avoid things like plastic or synthetic fibers when you are shopping for clothes? Do you try to seek out more natural fibers? Are you stymied trying to get the clothes you want and the fabrics you want? Do you have questions about whether sustainable clothing really is so sustainable? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Allison Chu is a reporter covering climate solutions for The Washington Post. She's written about microplastics in our clothes and what happens when we donate our clothing. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Do we have a sense of how large a pollutant microplastics from our clothes are compared to the other many sources of microplastics?
It's a great question. The experts that I spoke to while I was doing my reporting, generally say that when it comes to the overall plastics problem, you know, we know that that's massive, but microplastics are a significant portion of the plastic pollution that winds up in our waterways. And the tough thing about microplastics is, you know, in the name, they're very, very small bits. They can easily go down the drain, end up in our wastewater, end up in rivers and oceans. And in some cases, you know, they can also be small enough to be sort of released into the air, depending on, you know, where they're coming from. And so with things like clothes, microfibers are a type of microplastic, and it can come from, in many cases, it can come from sort of synthetic fabrics like polyester. Whenever you're beating your clothing around in the washing machine or in the dryer, or even sometimes with the friction of just wearing it, those really small fibers can shed.
And what are some of the harms we know about so far of having lots of these microfibers in things like our waterways?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that they can get everywhere, and not only in the environment, but also inside people's bodies. Researchers are telling me that the understanding of the impacts of microplastics on human health is still being studied, but there is some research on certain animals showing that exposure to microplastics can cause some negative health effects.
And you, in your recent piece, looked at what we as consumers can do to try to avoid releasing these microfibers from our clothing. What are some of the things that seem to make the most difference?
It's a really great question, and it is really hard to put the onus on consumers when it comes to this type of problem, because as many experts that I spoke with highlighted, the big fix is obviously changing the type of textiles that we use in a lot of clothing. But that's understandably a very big undertaking, and that requires change from industry and manufacturers. So in the meantime, unfortunately, it does sort of fall on the consumer to try to navigate the types of clothing that they're buying, and then how they're taking care of it and such, and especially with the washing and the drying. So there are things that you can put into your washing machine or dryer, whether they're bags or balls or filters that go, that you can add to your appliances that to a certain degree do filter and capture the microplastic, or sorry, the microfibers and stuff. And those have been tested in studies and, can be effective to a certain degree. Doesn't capture all of the fibers. There are some people who might think, if we know that the microplastic microfibers are mostly coming from synthetic materials, then, I'll just go buy natural things. But one expert that I spoke with noted that, there have been studies showing that natural fabrics will also shed fibers. And even though the fiber is from a quote-unquote natural source, once it's been turned into clothing, a lot of the cases, it's been chemically treated and things like that. And so we really don't know how quickly even the quote unquote natural fibers are going to degrade, in a natural environment. So again, this is maybe frustrating for some consumers to hear, but it is fairly complicated. And sometimes it can feel a little bit outside of control, but like I said earlier, there are different things you can add to your appliances. One fairly maybe sort of no-brainer step is you could wash and dry your clothes less. Mm-hmm. So not everything has to be washed every time you wear them. even though, you know, it is kind of very easy to toss into the hamper, but sometimes it's a little bit of intentional thinking about, I wore this, you know, polyester t-shirt one time. Do I really have to throw it into the wash?
We're talking to Allison Chu from the Washington Post about microplastics, microfibers, and other fibers in our clothing, how we can try to keep them from getting into the environment. She stays with us. Right now, we're going to zoom in on the fashion industry and what goes into choosing the fabrics in our clothes. Sarah Eileen Smith is a fashion and retail lecturer at UW Stout. She teaches about garment engineering and production. I talked with her yesterday. Here's a listen. Now, we hear about fibers, microfibers from our clothing, making it into the environment. What kinds of materials are those coming from?
All of those microfibers that you're thinking about are going to be from our synthetic fibers. So things like polyester, nylon, acrylic, a lot of things that we're really used to seeing in our wardrobes. So you're definitely going to be seeing synthetics responsible for some of those microfibers, aka microplastics that are entering our waterways.
When it comes to clothing design, what affects the decision of whether to use these petroleum-based plastic fibers in a garment?
A lot of what is actually influencing our fabric choice is the actual function of the garment. So what we expect it to actually do, what you want to wear it for, whether that's a product that you're going to be wearing when you're playing in a football game, or if it's something that you're going to wear to the beach, or something you'll wear to work in a corporate office. The fabric needs to be compatible with the end product. So that choice is going to be made really early on, and it's going to be very intentional based on the actual product you're trying to make. So whether or not the fiber is synthetic or natural in origin, like cotton or wool or something like that, is definitely going to be determined by what's the best choice for the product.
If, as a consumer, I carefully avoid all plastic products, only natural fibers, am I getting away clean? There's no downstream impact from fibers from my clothing, or are there still concerns?
Well, that's a great question. And I would say I would commend you, first of all, if you were able to do that and have your entire wardrobe be all naturally produced fibers, because we're so reliant in the masses on synthetic fibers. To answer your rootier question here, it is also tied into how do we actually dispose of our products. So no matter if it's a synthetic fiber or if you have a natural fiber, 100% organic cotton, if you throw that into the trash and it goes into a landfill, neither option is going to degrade at a natural rate. So that can be a real problem when we're thinking about cradle to cradle or something that we want to make sure doesn't have a negative impact on the environment. If we're just throwing it in a landfill, it can contribute to all the issues that we see from landfills. There's a lot of data out there about how synthetic fibers take a really long time to decompose and they don't degrade naturally, things like plastics. But if you're throwing that 100% organic cotton t-shirt into the landfill, depriving it of oxygen, it's not going to degrade the way it would if it were to be composted. So you would definitely see some ramifications in terms of the entire life cycle of the garment, even if you were able to make all of those perfectly educated choices on your fiber types.
Now, moving toward the front end here, there is a lot of concern out there, it seems like, about microplastics. Do you see clothing designers and manufacturers in any way moving away from the synthetic products that raise those microplastic concerns?
There are some companies out there that are definitely trying to address this. Part of the problem is that we don't think about what's happening to our clothes when they're in the wash and dry cycle, when we're actually laundering them. Those products that are made of synthetic fibers that go through your washing machine, naturally in the washing machine, clothes abrade against one another, and that takes some of the fibers away from the products that can wash out in the laundering. And then you get more agitation when you put it in the dryer. So a lot of simple things that you could see a manufacturer do is to suggest hang drying or flat drying products, because you'll get less agitation by not putting it through the dryer. It'll make your clothes last longer. Now that puts the onus on the actual consumer rather than on themselves. So there are definitely some choices being made about how do we manufacture products from the start that are going to be the most friendly. And then you do see companies taking initiatives like selling little filters you can put on your washing machine at home that should catch most of the microfibers or microplastics that are entering through the laundering system. But again, that's put on the consumer. So there are some changes being made, but our demand for products and the price point that we're willing to pay is going to influence what the opportunities are as well from a manufacturer standpoint.
And before I let you go, Sarah Eileen, I want to ask about durability as a factor in sustainability. We see a lot of these so-called fast fashion things real cheap, but not designed to last a whole long time. How big an issue in sustainability is, you know, that article of clothing that's going to last five wears versus going to last 5 years?
This is a huge thing for consumers right now. And the change that we're seeing from sustainable companies is that they're thinking more about this. They're trying to do away with the fast fashion aspect. I see this with my students a ton. They generally are going to be from Gen Z. They're more concerned with shopping secondhand. They're thinking more about where their products come from and how can they get longevity out of them. So part of it is you make a choice that's best for you. With durability in terms of the garment itself, a garment can be very durable, whether it's synthetic or it's actually natural fibers. Oftentimes with synthetic fibers, we can make specific choices in the formula we're actually extruding to create fibers, and those choices can make it extra strong. So we do have more control over that from synthetics, but we know that we have really good fibers that are natural that can stand the test of time. We were using cotton and wool and many different natural fibers long before we even had synthetics. And we have products that still exist from over 100, 200 years ago. You can go to museums and see products that have no synthetic fibers and they are still surviving. So part of it is going to be how we choose as consumers to interact with this idea of durability. But another part is that we see a lot of retailers actually reacting to the idea of how can I inspire my customer to actually make the sustainable choice and support our sustainable mission. And we're seeing a lot of consumers really excited about that. So it's kind of like a grassroots movement, and we're getting more and more traction as we go.
Sarah Eileen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a great, great time.
That was Sarah Eileen Smith, fashion and retail lecturer at UW-Stout. In just a minute, we're going to bring Allison Chu of the Washington Post back into the conversation about clothing, pollution, and sustainability. Coming up, we'll look at Allison's reporting on what happens when you donate your clothing, your old clothing. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on sustainability and clothing. Do you think about sustainability when you're buying clothes, or is it all about price, fit, and fashion? If so, you're not alone. Do you look for only natural fibers or things that are produced in a more environmentally acceptable way to you? And what happens at the end of your clothing's life? Do you donate it? Do you wonder what happens when you do donate it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up that conversation on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Allison Chu is with us, climate solutions reporter at the Washington Post, to talk about clothing, how it can be a source of microplastic pollution, what happens to our clothes when we throw them out or donate them. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you want to share how you shop for clothes, if you look at labels for particular ingredients, materials to avoid or chase after, what do you do with your clothes when you're done with them? Call 800-642-1234. Allison, you did a piece on that exact question. What happens to clothing when it goes away from us? What did you learn when you looked into clothing donations?
It's really fascinating. I feel like I always think about the questions that I have with my clothes, and one of them, what happens when I drop it off at my local donation center? And as I realized through my reporting, they're donating is a fantastic way to get rid of your old clothes without, directly having them end up in a landfill. But at the same time, there are, I think, some classic mistakes that I know I've made myself, and people that I've talked to have made, where Sometimes, you know, we're just not donating in the most intentional way. And in those cases, you can potentially, you know, do more harm than good in some of those situations. So that was really fascinating to learn about, because as one of the people that I spoke to noted, you know, there is this idea when it comes to donating clothes that whatever you give is going to go to a good home, and someone is going to love this top or these pants that I don't want anymore. And that's really not always the case.
What are some of the things to definitely not do when we donate?
I think first and foremost is obviously not donating anything that is, you know, visibly wet or soiled mm-hmm. in some way, or, you know, just completely unwearable. You know, some large donation places will take things that are a little stained or ripped. But if it's really gross and you probably wouldn't wear it, donating it is not a great idea. Some other things to keep in mind is, you know, donating clothing, in the correct season. So, a great example of that is don't donate your heavy winter coats or sweaters in the summer. You know, that's not something that's going to be in high demand when the weather is warm. But you can save that to donate, you know, in the fall or in the winter.
We're talking about clothing and sustainability with Allison Chu from The Washington Post. Let's bring on a caller. Roseanne is with us in Wausau. Roseanne, hi.
Hi. Say, my question has to do with microfibers getting into the air. Your guest said that when we shake them and move, you know, articles of clothing and whatnot, that these fibers can get into the air. And when I think about infant sleepers made from fleece, throws, blankets, even our stuffed animals, I'm wondering, are we constantly breathing in, and our children constantly breathing in these microfibers into our lungs? Has there been any research on that?
Roseanne, thanks for the call. Allison, I don't remember in your piece if any experts brought up the issue of potentially inhaling microfibers directly from the stuff as we're wearing it.
It's a great question. I don't believe that was covered in the reporting that I did. And as we talked about earlier, you know, the understanding of the health impacts of having microfiber, microplastics in our bodies is still being studied. We do, you know, there is research out there saying that, finding that it has, you know, microplastics are in our bodies. But exactly what the impact of that is health-wise is still being understood. But we do have research suggesting that, you know, when you throw your clothes into the dryer and it's tumbling around in there and there's a dryer exhaust, you know, fibers can be released in that way. Or as we talked about, it can be some can be released as you're, you know, rubbing around, wearing your clothes, but the exact health impacts still being researched at the time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Roseanne. Now, Allison, people concerned about sustainability of their clothing might look for labels that give them cues. In your reporting, you know, if we see things that are labeled as sustainable or eco-friendly or whatever, can we put a lot of stock in those kind of statements made by clothing manufacturers?
It's definitely a complicated question. There is a lot of greenwashing that happens in the fashion industry. So, you know, there are things where maybe it sounds really great. It sounds super sustainable, but in reality, it's not as transformative as the marketing makes it seem, mm-hmm. basically. And so, the sustainable fashion experts that I spoke to about this, you know, they all really emphasize that. At the moment right now, it is, again, on the consumer to dive into research, really look into brands, see if, you know, once you go to websites and things like that, you know, are they really backing up the sustainability claims that they make? You know, do they have these third-party reports assessing their manufacturing and supply chain process? Do their clothes come with sort of some of the widely accepted certifications, whether it's organic or, you know, whatever else. And there are databases of certifications. There are a lot of groups that have searchable databases for brands and things like that to again, really help consumers try to navigate whether a company that says they're being sustainable is actually, putting actions to those words.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That's Allison Chu, reporter covering climate solutions for The Washington Post. She talked to us about her recent reporting on how to cut down on microplastic pollution coming from our clothes. We also heard from garment design expert Sarah Eileen Smith from UW-Stout. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Texas judge overturned the FDA's approval of a drug used in abortions, and things are up in the air in the midst of appeals to that ruling. Get the latest on that and some other big legal issues in the post-Roe v. Wade world. And join the search for some of Wisconsin's most majestic birds. Find out how you can get involved in the annual crane count here in the state. And check in on the well-being of Wisconsin's sandhills and the whoopers. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the diabetes drug Ozempic is being used for weight loss as well, and there's a lot of hype around it. A Wisconsin diabetes doctor tells us about the medication and answers some common questions. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.